Hi, film fans. It's Friday, and I know we don't normally give you an episode on a Friday, but we have a bonus episode for you today. And as it is Friday, I just wanted to throw out a few things that are available for you guys to see in the cinema. One of those you might have heard us talk about on Monday's episode of the podcast with Amelia Warner, the wonderful composer behind Young Woman in the Sea. It is a beautiful film, directed by Joachim Ronning and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who may well be coming up on an extra bonus episode in the next week or so. And it stars Daisy Ridley, and it tells the story of this young woman called Trudy Edderley, who in 1926 was the first woman to swim the English Channel. That's all I'm going to tell you. You need to go and see this film. You need to go and see it in the cinemas, and it is out today. Also in cinemas is Hitman, the latest film from Richard Linklater, which stars Glenn Powell, who also co-wrote the film with Richard. And I'm happy to say that in the next week or so, we have Richard Linklater back on soundtracking as well. That's going to be in cinemas for a couple of weeks, and then it hits Netflix on the 7th of June, I think it is. So there you go, a couple of excuses, not that you need them, to get yourself out to the cinema. Go on, go and do it. You know you want to. But our latest guests on soundtracking are the wonderful Abby Morgan and Lucy Forbes, respectively the writer and director of the quite extraordinary Eric, which is available to watch right now on Netflix. Now, you might have seen this kind of everywhere, to be honest. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch, and it is a really wonderful, I was about to say complicated, but it's not complicated. It's really hard to describe this series in a couple of sentences because it really would do it an injustice. But I guess broadly speaking, it involves a man who believes he can find his missing son with the help of a giant puppet called Eric. As well as featuring a host of incredible needle drops, Eric is scored by Kiefer Ciancia, and we'll begin with his cue, Edgar's Drawings. I've got to say, first off, huge congratulations. This is just, you know, having watched telly and films for as long as I have, it's very rare that you watch something and it feels completely unique, feels familiar, but it feels something that's totally brand new.
Well, that's gorgeous,
thank
Edith
you.
Bowman. Thank
yeah.
you so much.
Thank you.
Like you straight away, come and sit on my mantelpiece every day. I mean, I think it's a real... it's a real testimony, actually, to Lucy's brilliance at bringing that world to life. I genuinely mean that, because we talked a lot about that era of the 70s affecting the 80s and the palette. And, you know, I think so many of the mood images that you came with, we'd also been talking a lot about.
Yeah.
And what's so great is sometimes directors come with that stuff and you know, actually see it appear on the screen. Mm. But I think it's the way, the translation and the interpretation of that and the ability to share that idea with so much, such a big collaborative team in terms of Alexander Holmes, the
yeah.
production designer, through to Suzanne Cave, the costume designer, through to Andrew Baseman, who's an amazing
set
deck that's done beautiful visual work. So I think it's a real tribute to that in terms of its look and its feel, and I hope that feels both specific
mm-hmm.
and unique.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
That's what it's playing with, don't you think?
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. Before you came on, Lucy, though, Abby, if you don't mind just starting with
yeah.
the kind of, you know, the idea for this, what was the kind of spark? What was the catalyst for this? And also the idea that it would be episodic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the joy of TV, isn't it? That you can tell those stories and you can interrogate character in that way. And I think I always knew this was a character-based piece. I mean, really at its simplest, I grew up, my dad ran theatres. So I grew up with those kind of crazy, toxic, brilliant mavericks. And I did spend a lot of time in workshops and rehearsal rooms. And, you know, one of my earliest memories is the scratch of those red seats on, in the old theatres, which was because that's where I used to get dumped to sleep, and that's my memory of this, that the kind of smell of MDF. So I wanted to write about a creative world that put a kid at its heart. Mm-hmm. So, and initially I was going to do it all through the perspective of Edgar, and then I realised Edgar had to disappear in order to really be able to properly examine this man and this world. And so that was the kind of greatest part. And then I'd spent a little bit of time in the mid-80s in New York looking after a kid, and I'd watched endless rounds of Sesame Street and The Muppets, and I grew up on that stuff as well. Mm. I think most kids who grew up in the 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties probably did. And so it was also a desire to go ahead and go, well, what happens if this maverick New York that I'd experienced in the 80s, what happens if I put this other thing, which is the kind of Muppet on our shoulders, the kind of monster that's kind of lurks in the dark shadows within ourselves. And that's where the kind of metaphor of Eric was really born.
There's almost kind of quite a few different stories going on at one time. Mm. And I love that, you know, in terms of the characters that we get to know and the stories and the things that unfold, and you're kind of guessing as where you think it's going to go, and then it surprises you. It's just so packed and beautifully entertaining. Lucy, when you first read the scripts, what was the kind of thing that really jumped out for you that you kind of latched on to particularly, do you think?
Just how wildly exciting it would be to work on the show. I mean, to create a puppet show from scratch, which is what we did, was, I mean, the most sort of creatively rewarding thing that I've ever done. And then on top of that, exploring the New York club scene, exploring a domestic drama, a police drama, it was just so multi-layered and there was so much. And as a sort of UK director to be handed over 80s New York as a playground was just... I couldn't have asked for more.
And what was that starting point then? Where do you start? You kind of going, yep, it's yours. Where do you go from? Where's the starting point?
Before our first meeting, I usually put like big lookbooks together to try and get my head into the world and head into the show. And I sort of like locked myself in my office away for 2 weeks and pretty much looked at every single photograph that was ever taken in 1980s New York and sort of ordered them in a way and sort of tried to work out what the tone of the show would be. And that ultimately, that became our reference throughout the whole production, really. You can constantly go back through there. And actually, I looked at it the other day and there's so much in this document that has made it into the show. But just research on research on research, and then just really thinking about how to bed in the time period. I just didn't want it to be like, hey, it's a 1980s show and big hair and neon colours, because that's not the reality. And so just trying to work out how to make, you know, New York sing, but it not, 80s New York not become a distraction, just become weaved in and part of everything. That a lot of that to do is that, you know, ultimately, not when 1979 turns 1980, not everything changes. The decades bleed into each other.
Yeah.
And because Vincent's really heyday was probably in the 70s, you know, you pull that with you through your life.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to pull that into our world. So we're sort of, it's a nod to the late 70s, it's a nod to the 80s, but it also, I wanted it to have a sort of timelessness to it as well.
And it's also that thing that you're learning something. I feel like I was learning quite a lot about that period and that era that you kind of think you know, you know, because you've watched it on films or TV shows, but particularly that whole kind of community underground and what was going on there, and the way that you've kind of depicted that is extraordinary and so powerful as well. There was a documentary that you found that was...
Oh, there's this amazing documentary called Dark Days, which is filmed, I think it's early 90s, and it's completely about the community that lived in the tunnels. It's a really amazing, amazing documentary, and we were really, really heavily referenced it, and it's sort of heartbreaking and tragic. You'll absolutely love it.
Yeah,
it's the soundtrack's by DJ Shadow,
it
kind of starts off very just following these guys that live underground. It feels really normal, and just their incredibly like tragic, traumatic tales of survival are slowly revealed throughout the film. Which I think you took as a huge reference.
Yeah, it was a huge reference, but also I think it's two things. I think you're so right, you picked up on that resonance and that 70s was so important. But the thing that's so interesting about that specific documentary is it's so dark. It's so dark, and then somehow the lighting, because they didn't have the kind of level of bright lighting, they're opening the door and you get these shafts of light, life onto these worlds. And so it's almost like a kind of tracking light through those dark tunnels. And I think that shadow of darkness and light is where that came from. But also, you know, it was a massive production that, I mean, yeah. It was built, that's built under these incredible tunnels in Budapest. And it's, I mean, there's a cathedral under one of these tunnels. That's how vast they are. And they're used as great diving, a diving center, because they go on so deep.
Wow.
So, so the fact that you recreated that, I mean, I think I've never seen you under so many layers of puffer and coat,
because it was freezing. So cold.
It was so cold. So it was a physical, you know, to actually be down there and to realize that actually it was emulating the subway, but how cold it would have been. That film, I think, is a real touchstone, isn't it, for the whole building of that. But I think your execution of that is so brilliant and immense. I mean, immense.
It's enormous.
Well, I couldn't believe that, like, part of the film was filmed in Budapest as well. That was kind of like, wait a minute, what?
80%.
Wow.
We were in Budapest for, I mean, we did a month in New York, and the rest was, we started shooting in January, shot for best part of nearly 5 months in Budapest, and then we did the last month in New York.
Yeah.
But Budapest offered us, it had a New York backlot, which was built for Hellboy 2.
Which was vast.
But
easy connection,
yeah. But really, really crumbling. And we had to do a lot of work to get it into up scratch, into Nick, to build. That's where the Lux is, and that's where we
The Good Day Sunshine sort of charity event that takes place in episode 5.
Entrance in and out of the tunnel.
I mean, I've got so many questions about the music, because the music as well has got, like, there's so many roles the music has. So you've got in the club, you've got Good Day Sunshine, that whole kind of musical scope and around that. You've got the amazing needle drops that are in that Joan Armatrading track in particular. I think I was just like, and the way it's used across three storylines at that, is it three or four?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's just perfection. And then the score. Where should we start? I mean, are you writing music into the script? Are you writing cues? Are you writing
my alternate universe would be that person who could do that. But I'm not going to take any credit for the music in this, I have to say, because, I mean, I think there's a couple of things. You're right, you know, the Good Day Sunshine theme tune, which is its own earworm, written by the brilliant Tim Minchin, who just, you know, I think, I mean, managed to encapsulate that song.
It's incredible.
Identify that show so brilliantly within hours of us asking, which was amazing. And sure will be forever
great. Overnight.
Incredible.
No.
Yeah.
Incredible. I mean, that's what he gets the big bucks for, you realise, because he's just brilliant.
We just did one Zoom call, and then it arrived in our inbox the Monday morning. We're like, what?
It changed anything. Yeah.
One, two, three, four. The trees are green and the sky is blue. The sun is up and it's smiling down on you. Hello, world, what you doing today?
I put your hand in mine.
Come on, let's play.
And if you're feeling shy, never you fear.
Fuck my shocker.
The wrong side of my bed.
But even when everything's going wrong, remember that gray skies don't last long.
Totally that going on. I think I'm more comfortable in the kind of composed music and understanding the kind of themes and narratives, although I'm a sonic dumbwit, so I've really had to learn about what's that then?
Come on,
how does that work? But the real mic drop, the real needle drop, as you say, is, I think, Lucy's impeccable music taste, which at times I would say have been controversial.
We've discussed, let's be honest here.
You know, because I think for me, I was worried about the kind of branding, and yet what's been so interesting in kind of going back to all the music specifically for this podcast, specifically for this interview, has been to go, oh my God, there is, you know, they do capture the atmosphere, the thematic journey of that episode so often, right the way from Forest by the Cure in episode 2, which is, feels like it's quite aggressive and violent for me, but actually it's a brilliant out through to Fairport Convention, which I think we probably discussed for quite a long time. episode yeah. 5. There's no, I don't think we should try and hide this. Didn't understand it at all. Now I think it's really beautiful and it really lands. And sometimes it takes, unfortunately, it takes,
but
you know.
But you react to different, I think you react to music in a really unique way as yeah. well, because it takes you away to a certain extent if it's lyrically too heavy sometimes.
Yeah, I think lyrics were very yeah. interesting for me, where I'd be, you know, yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's that probably that crossover. I think when we go back to the music, the thing that feels really important is, and made sense of it for me, was something really simple, which was, it was basically, each track for me was probably something that him, i.e. Vincent, and Lenny got stoned to sometime in the yeah. 70s. Mm. And somehow that laid, I got it. And it's been it was a real, like, psychological opening for me. It was the kind of, you know, Coke bottle twist for me, where I went, oh, I get it, okay. So it's been interesting. It's been a really interesting journey.
That's such an interesting way of describing the choice of needle drops as such, because a lot of the time they don't have a direct connection mm. within the film diegetically to the characters, because mm. it's not being played diegetically a lot of the time. Mm. But this, clearly, that's an amazing conversation.
For me, music is where I start. So I start a playlist when I started mm. putting the mood boards together, and they just build and build and build as we go. And I also put playlists together for the cast members. So mm. Gabby got a playlist in line with Cassie, and the Joan Armour Trading was on that. I made a massive playlist about what Vincent and Lenny would be listening to when they were creating Good Day Sunshine and they were stoned out of their minds, and what kind of bands they were in. And then Edgar got like a sort of 80s bangers, because, you know, he was nine and had no idea about 80s music. So it's sort of, that's where it goes. And yes, as Abby was saying, it's very much that sort of Joan, Gabby really sort of attached to that, really grabbed hold of Joan Armour Trading and listened to a lot of it, sort of preparing for the character. And that sort of moment when she dances in the apartment, when she's finally by herself for the first time after all this sort of trauma and tragedy, and she just could let herself go, that was just off the cuff. We just decided to do it.
Well, I think more importantly, it was the day I was on set, and it was running into the little bathroom of the apartment set, and you pulling up your laptop and going, no, it should be Joan Armour Trading, no, Love and Affection, no, you know. And of course, Love and Affection, you all think you own that track, because it's one of those talismanic tracks, isn't it? It's totemic, talismanic, I'm confusing those words too. But it's probably the track I love most of all of the tracks in the whole show, and I think it speaks to the fact that it's director and writer who found the same beat of the same moment at the heart in the show in that moment. And I thank you for that now, because there are lots of great tracks in this. It'll definitely be on the Spotify playlist, and I will not be able to take credit for it, but I probably mercilessly will from now on. I came up with that one.
I am not in love, but I'm open to persuasion, east or west, where's the best for romancing with a friend? I can smile, but with a lover I could hold my head back and really laugh, really laugh.
But it was a really special moment on set, wasn't it?
It was a really special moment. And also, you know, set is so vulnerable. Mm. And I think music for you really unlocks that vulnerability, but allows also actors to feel comfortable. And watching Gabby let rip on that dance move was really moving. Yeah. Really, really
We
moving.
All cried. Yeah. We really, because we just did it. It was, as I said, we hadn't really planned it. And we just sort of threw it on and just, you know, played the whole track through, which is pretty full on to ask an actor to do. You know, we literally told her 10 minutes before we did it that we were going to do it.
Yeah.
She hadn't, she hadn't really thought about it. It's like, Gabby, do you want to just do this and see what happens? And she was like, yeah. And I think how many times did we shoot it? Twice?
Twice. Yeah. It's also that thing, you know, they quiet on set, and everyone goes quiet. And sometimes there's a quiet on set, but people are looking at their phones.
Yeah, but everyone's like...
But it's one of those moments where you could really feel quiet on set. People were really in that moment. Yeah, it was... it's an amazing thing.
But that's testament to you and the set you create. And that's... I've seen Gabby comment on that, you know, in terms of, like, she felt she'd never really had that experience that she's had that you created on set, in terms of safe space, but also just allowing, you know, protective of the actors, but also protective but open, and giving them the opportunity to play and, you know, feel what they, and talk about what they wanted to talk about as well. So you've got to take credit for that.
I'll take it. But also, if you want sort of naturalistic, beautiful performances, you have to make everyone feel safe. And I mean, ultimately, just don't be a dick, and then everyone's going to do a good job.
But I think all directors should have those up on a t-shirt.
Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
With their name on it.
Just a mirror reflected upwards. Yeah, exactly.
What's forming your choices of making those playlists for everybody then? Are you thinking about character backstory, like, you know, we were talking about Vincent and Lenny and what they would listen to when they were stoned, or emotional state, or all of it?
All of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a massive music geek, and I really spend hours, but I really second guess, because also I don't want to put stuff on this that's played out or that has been overused, because 80s has been done to death. Mm-hmm. And so I really consider one character lyrically, emotionally, would they be connected to it? How it connects to the story? Has it been played on Stranger Things 5 times? Or, you know, just making sure that we're not covering old ground.
Yeah.
A lot of it is instinctual. Some of it is just like, I have huge playlists of collections of songs that I hold back, like a gatekeep for special occasions, and some of them came
and
out.
It was very sweet. There's moments where very sweet you'd go, I've got a track. And you know, it had been saved.
It's been in the vault.
It's been saved from This Is Gonna Hurt for us.
But it literally, it like comes out of the vault and then close the vault and don't let anyone look at the vault. I'm so protective over it. I did an interview a couple of days ago, and they asked me to send them the playlist that I made for the actors, and I was like, really sorry, but I don't want them to be public.
Oh, wow.
Because I just don't want them.
It's private between you and the actor, really.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, too. I mean, it's fine to mention, to talk about a couple of tracks on there, but I feel so it's almost in a way, you know, when you ask actors to talk about their process in a way. And they kind of get the eye roll sort of thing. And it's like, it's almost kind of diving even deeper than that in a way, in terms of it's their kind of like the vault in a way. It's kind of like, it's my
special music vault. You're not coming in.
Get out.
Yeah, get out of my music vault. I spent years building this up.
I want to go to this vault now. I think it's got,
I'll let you in.
It's definitely got chipping. It's got lounge furniture, I feel. And probably a bar in the corner.
Yeah.
And definitely a gallery wall of old album covers.
Yeah.
What about when it came to like you got the club as well, Lux, in terms of what's kind of going on in there, and the sound of that, and New York at that period as well, it has a whole, it has its own soundtrack in a way, really. Mm. And so there are sort of familiarities there, but there's also like similar to what I was saying at the very start of it, feeling different and unique as well.
Again, this is me not wanting to play stuff that feels played out so I properly did my research in terms of what kind of stuff was going to be played there. I had a really good consultant, a DJ really, he's a disco DJ, like probably one of the best in London, called Frank Tope.
Yeah.
And he is a massive New York club scene geek. And so we just talked it through, and he sent loads and loads of suggestions and made mixes, because at the beginning we were talking about, we want to feel the mix in the club, we want to hear the record. But when it came to the edit, we just didn't need it, because we weren't hanging in scenes long enough. But I had lots and lots of conversations with him, and then just wanted to pick the stuff that people hadn't really heard, but really felt like, and sort of represented the Lux. You know, the Lux is the kind of place that you can go and be what you want to be.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can push those decisions too far, or you just have a great time just dancing. But it just wanted to get that feeling across.
Mm. Yeah, and also the Lux had to be a place that kind of had joy and threat.
Yes.
And so it was always about having a sound track and amazing. I mean, the Gloria track, which is so integral to the coming alive of Eric and Vincent, and that kind of trip, is also the importance of it. Is it's the muffled sound of it through a doorway when, you know, LaDroit is there, or the feeling that there's always another conversation that becomes incredibly important in episode 2 with the picking up of the other kind of sound. So it's using music that absolutely is emblematic of the time, but it can also be absorbed in the walls of the city as well. And so becomes a kind of muffled soundtrack to it as well.
Yeah.
it's almost that thing of, in a way of kind of, I don't know if you do, where you kind of sometimes you're walking down the street and you have your own soundtrack of your life playing in your head in a way, to a thing as you slightly almost like dance
was.
Walk down the street.
Yeah. Well, you can have your filmic moments, can't you? Literally,
you're coming around a corner.
Hey! It's like silent disco is such a great thing, isn't it? Oh. Everyone's dancing to different rhythms, but you're all in your own.
As soon as I heard Gloria, I immediately just wanted to go find a karaoke bar.
Yeah, Delta app.
Absolutely. It's just one of those songs as well. Were there films or... I mean, mostly films, I guess, that were reference points as well, because there's, I love how it looks as well, you know, in terms of, and there are things as well, I think, that where there are children involved in films in that period of New York, like whether it, Kramer versus Kramer.
Kramer is really important to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was as, I mean, the French toast scene is pure, just a lift. It's a homage to that. But, you know, also, you know, Tootsie, I love that film. Obviously, it's a slightly later period. But again, you have your brilliant walk and talks through the city. Right back to Taxi Driver, you know, Mean Streets. There's a million films that you go back to where the city has been such a muse.
Yeah.
I think what I love about what Lucy's done to this is that she's brought the palette of the 70s rather than the 80s. I think there could have been a very kind of dialed up, turned up kind of, you know, beatbox version of this show. And I think it's always paying homage to the 70s, but also for me, the 60s and the kind of, you know, America at that time, which was, it'd gone through the Vietnam War. It was filled with this underclass, you know, the little veteran who's on the subway was actually a veteran I saw in the mid 80s. Basically, you know, the speech is almost word for word what I saw him do on the underground, and realizing there was this kind of lost generation as well. Mm. So, New York feels like a film set. You know, we've grown up on Cagney and Lacey. Yeah. And also New York is where people film. You know, we're playing around with that idea. It was the place where you filmed as well. Mm. So, you know, I've rarely been to New York where I haven't seen a film crew of some kind in New York as well. So it's a muse and a character in its own right, I think.
Was it nice to be on the flip side of that, of being that film set on New York filming?
I would have loved that, but unfortunately we had a writer's strike, which meant the day before I was about to fly out and stop. But
I think I probably had my. I feel bad because you were there. We missed you desperately. We had this day. It was like the second to last day, and we were filming on a basketball court, and it was like glorious sunshine, and just like all the cast kind of just dropped by to hang out, which is something that does not happen in the UK, but it happens in America. They just came and they were all the Good Day Sunshine crew that were in town, just everyone came and hung out.
Having a nice time, Lucy.
A couple of very famous actresses just popped in because they were passing, and they're friends of Gabby, and they were there, and I was like, oh my God, I don't want to say their name, but they popped out. We were by the monitors, and some insanely famous DOP just saw that we were shooting, popped in, came to have a look at the monitors. Mm. And it was just this sort of enormous...
It was a block party.
Yeah,
it was just... and I wasn't there. So interesting.
Sorry, I know, but it's... No, I'm sorry, but it was...
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing that counters the bitterness and the pain is that it looks very good. And actually, to go back to your... Which is the seamless segue between Budapest and New York is really apparent in the whole kind of big run, which obviously is this kind of New York part of the film. I've probably blown it for anybody who wants to play that game, but...
yeah.
You know, I think it is so interesting that in a weird way... There was this kind of very easy segue of those two worlds, but it took a lot to get there for you guys, you know.
And then just going back to the music as well with Kiefer's, because
Kiefer's, really.
You've all that stuff that we've talked about, and then you've got score as well, sort of to connect, to weave within all of that as well. That's not an easy ask, you know, so that it doesn't feel like it's a kind of clang of like, oh, there's the score. He's done an amazing job. What were the conversations and why Kiefer's as well? Mm.
Kiefer's just, we met with Kiefer's, he's just so enthusiastic about the show and really, really understood it and really understood as, I mean, the sort of light and dark of the show. And he kind of did, he sort of just talked about his process. Ultimately, he just wants to go and lock himself away and make a sort of library of sounds, a sort of library of sounds of New York. Mm. And then from that, he will then draw from that and then start building the sonic world. And that's what we did. And we sort of talked about making a sort of like slightly sort of twisted version of the Good Day Sunshine theme, which actually never really ended up making it in. But ultimately, he took elements of that song and then sort of built these these really, really beautiful themes that sort of return throughout this, yeah. Especially, I really love the sort of repeating Edgar theme, which you first hear when he comes into his room after the subway home with his dad, and that repeats throughout. He just has incredibly talented at getting that balance right. But, you know, you don't want to, like, signal the feelings too much yeah. or push things too much. And he just...
Or date it as well. In that
yes,
period,
exactly,
like,
yeah.
I think also he was interesting. He understood the kind of thematic layers going on in the show, but also the physical. So we talked a lot about New York as a city with the kind of muscularity of the subway and the kind yeah. of feeling of the kind of steel and iron of construction of New York versus this kind of emotional heart or the counterpoint or the weirdness of Eric. So you played a lot with those kind of bubble sounds around Eric, which kind of, you know, were dialed up and dialed down, yeah. or even this descending piano scale that when, you know, there's a key moment where Cassie thinks she sees her son on the underground and there's this descending piano scale, which is one of my favourite bits. And I think the reason why it works is because it's very rare against this very sort of muscular soundtrack mm-hmm. to hear this fragility. And I think that's where he was really beautiful, is that yeah. there was this counterpoint of something which felt very like a city and the mechanic and the vibe of the city against this kind of fragile relationships that were hanging on by a thread, which is, you know, sort of what we're playing against throughout thematically in the show.
It's that kind of synergy between the performances and what you hear as well, you know. And I just think, did he write pre-filming, during filming, after filming?
It was after.
Okay, yeah, because yeah, you feel that kind of...
A lot of the images.
Yeah, that connection with those cuts. Characters and those performances, I think, in particular.
But also, I think as a collaboration, you're learning to find the language, aren't you, as well? In motion, you're trying to work out how does it work. You know, we can have someone in the team who's very sonically, musically attuned to someone like me, who I'm literally like... I like the rumbly bit, but I'm not sure, you know, and it's learning how to collaborate in that way to find, so that you can come to something that doesn't just feel like a sort of sanitized, acceptable version, you know, there's, that you're all kind of defining what that music's meant to do, what that score's meant to do. I mean, I listen to score probably more than anything, actually, to work to, because I have to write without lyrics. So I often listen to score as a work when I'm writing.
Did you listen to anything particular whilst you were
writing? I listened... Well, actually, I'd listened to a lot of The Theory of Everything, which is a weird thing, but it's about pace. And I love Johansson's pace, you know, the way he uses pace in that. Subsequently, I've been listening to a lot of Past Lives, funnily enough. And I think there's a sort of... Which is another New York-based theme, you know, that's also about nostalgia with another country. But I find scores... incredibly help. I listen to lots of, obviously, Hans Zimmer. Love his scoring, so I listen to loads of that.
Love the idea of you listening to that while you're dramatically banging out a script.
Yeah, I use it. I mean, funny enough, I use it. Yeah,
like you're playing the piano.
Yeah, yeah.
Like maestro.
It's more like this. More than internet shopping.
Oh yeah,
like that. I love the idea of that. I mean, banging. There's very little. There's some gentle tapping, and long pauses, and a lot of slurping of tea, munching of chocolate, and then back to a bit of gentle tapping.
Yeah.
Well, what you come out with the gentle tapping is amazing. Yeah,
it takes time.
It's really good.
A lot of time, a lot of chocolate.
The casting, there's just pristine, you know, in terms of right through this as well. McKinley, oh my God, just like, he felt really familiar, that I'd seen him in lots of things, but this just felt like I didn't ever want him to leave the screen, to be honest, because he's just got this incredible presence. And Benedict, I mean, we've seen Benedict in so many things. But you've given him the ability to show something that we've not seen. It's brilliant.
It's funny, actually. I was thinking about this today, and I was thinking about Benedict because, He's someone I like to think about quite a lot. but I was thinking about him, and I was thinking about what I think Lucy has done for him as a director. And I think one of the things that Lucy gave him was space. Mm. And the reason why I say that is I remember seeing him on that first scene, and he was allowed to play. Mm-hmm. And then he would turn and go, almost look to go, is that all right? And actually what you were very good at doing was letting him try again and find his way and be very strategic about when you delivered notes to him. And everything is about casting, I think. Would you not agree? If you don't, it does so much work for you. And I think we both, when we first met Benedict, you know, I think we both, well, I know I thought I knew him before I met him.
Yeah.
And the surprise was how curious and how, as McKinley just said, he was willing to roll up his sleeves and do the work.
Yeah.
And I think where there was a really good fusion was that the kind of combination of his ability and his desire to work and be curious met with the space that Lucy gave him is I think what's the performance is incredible. In terms of McKinley, watching that first scene, which was done in sort of real time, where he went to interview Vincent and Cassie as in that first scene,
in
the shock for me the way he could hold his silence.
Yeah.
And realising he's up against, you know, McKinley is a phenomenal actor, but we all know that Benedict was the kind of star. And to see McKinley hold his space with, you know, with Benedict, and for you to hold your nerve to allow that to happen is a real tribute, I think, to you as a director. I think it's a real tribute to that kind of alchemy that was born between those actors, also the space that was allowed on set.
Was that surprising to you, you know, in terms of kind of how, kind of, you know, you say rolled up your sleeves he was with this character in this particular role?
But not really. I mean, I expected a certain level, but I got much, much, much more than I expected.
Yeah.
But also we were so lucky that he's so gifted. He's such a gifted voice actor as well. So he voices Eric and, you know, created voices for
Smart.
Yeah, exactly. But also created voices for all our puppets. But, you know, also has a real connection. He really connected with the story.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, lucky us, just really wanted to do the absolute best job he possibly could. And as you say, I feel very happy. I really do feel like we are seeing him in a different space, which, you know, you don't, I mean, for me, my big thing is I don't want him to look like Benedict Cumberbatch. I want him, because he has such a, but he does look like himself, obviously, but I didn't want it to feel similar to how we've seen him before.
Yeah.
I think that's why I like pieces that also show people doing work, because so often an actor has to learn how to do that job. And it's the old sort of Stanislavski ideas. If you want to make a speech work, give them a toothbrush. You know, if you've got an action in the middle of it, and there was something fascinating about watching the whole creative team work on Good Day Sunshine, which again, I think is really a tribute to Lucy's creation of that show.
It's crazy that you had to create, you actually created the show within the film.
Yeah.
Imagine they had to learn a puppeteer then, basically.
Yeah, and that was amazing. Well, yeah, we did.
No, they did.
And that was, you know, and what was amazing was watching actors hold a puppet and then have to watch a screen to watch their performance. Mm-hmm. Immediately that takes them out of the experience of being an actor and they had to be a puppeteer. And I think that's what you really capture as well, is you capture actors doing another skill, which is really exciting.
We did, we had Tim Mitchell had written the theme tune and the actors had been in like puppet camp for weeks.
Yeah.
And we were coming up to sort of shooting, we were coming to shooting the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
And I just went in, just literally popped, I think we've been shooting all day, popped into the theatre for rehearsal, and suddenly they're all there, all their puppets, and then they just sing the theme tune. I burst into tears.
Yeah.
I was so happy. Oh, wow. I was like, oh my God, it's happening.
But
it's happening, because we'd spent so, I mean, we started to design the puppets in June. The puppet design took, I mean, when did we start shooting? April? February.
Wow. January.
But it was, I mean, Eric, the process of the design of Eric was enormous.
I bet.
And took every single tiny aspect of it just took a very, very long time. But also so did all the puppets, to actually have them arrive and everyone be whole. I was like, oh my God, they're here. Thank God they're here and they're ready to go.
Were the actors involved in terms of, because the characters, let me get this right. So the characters that the actors are playing that are then playing puppet characters, in terms of what those would be and what their voices would be and what their personalities would be. I love that there's a Scottish one in there as well.
Smack them all.
Specifically for you.
Thank you.
But that's, I mean, that's layers, you know, in terms of kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I think we always talked about, there's a tiny little moment in episode 3 where Lenny sees that Vincent's framed a napkin of the drawing of Bug, and Mush, you know.
Yeah, the first one.
And we, I think we always, that's how far the thinking went, which was, you know, they drew this on a napkin some when they were pissed art students. And yeah, they've always seen, I've always thought Bug and Mush are a kind of manifestation of a young Lenny and Vincent. I mean, in truth, I think they were spiders and something else at the beginning, weren't they? In the original.
Originally, it was a butterfly and a spider.
Yeah, but actually, I think that's when, again, Lucy was saying, we need something that feels animate in this that we can mm-hmm. relate to. And actually, that opened up the world. What did Good Day Sunshine mean? What does it really resonate about? And suddenly, you know, it's really at the core, which is this mythical idea he has of a city. And then we come to understand that this park he fell in love with is also built on its on a lie, you know, and that's so the show has all these resonances, these layers, but at its simplest, they're just gorgeous. They are gorgeous, gorgeous puppets and stitches and glue, and you know, the team there were just phenomenal at bringing them to life. But I've never seen anyone work as hard as Lucy did over the building barrier, because the problem is there are so many other monsters to circumnavigate, aren't there?
Oh, gosh.
But it's the detail in him and the pull through of narrative and the narrative. Connectivity of it.
You know, tail is the, like the cat's tail or the chevron's
fur coat and Benedict's eyes. And
then the chevron that's then picked up on the coat, which is also, you know, on
Anne's coat.
Yeah, but on Edgar's coat as well. Oh, yeah, all related. So all the chevron thing becomes really important. Yeah.
Took a long time, but also it needed to feel 80s, but also belong on Good Day Sunshine, and but also work in the streets of New York.
Yeah.
So, because originally it was going to be a bright blue.
I did at one point think you'd slightly lost it when we started talking about dancing and singing pretzels and hot dogs, but they're there.
I love them so much.
Yeah. Who doesn't love a dance and pretzel? Reminds me of Greece. Oh, the advert in Greece?
Again, another great reference point. You see, all those films would be, I mean, if I look back to my childhood, most of it was based on American TV and American films. Why was Absolutely. Why did it all seem so much
bored
cooler?
In here.
We had Digby, the biggest dog in the world, was like,
oh my God, I remember that.
Do you remember? And the double deckers.
Oh my God. Digby, the biggest. Digby. I haven't seen that. I watched that so many times. Yeah. Why Eric?
You know, it's really funny because, I mean, there's a couple of things. Partly, and I don't even want to say this out loud, but I loved Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise. I grew up in. So Eric, but also there was Eric, who was the big moustache cop. Was it the other moustache cop in, you know, I'm going to get it, Starsky and Hutch, you know.
Right.
Was Eric, whatever his name was. No. Anyway, Eric was just felt like an American name. If I, you know, I just thought, okay, it just felt like a kind of, and it's weird because we played around with that title so much, you know. I think there was a concern about it being the name of a thing, of a person, and actually I think we tried every different version, but in the end we came back to Eric. So there's it's a kind of anomaly, really. It's just a name, but it's the imaginary friend we all carry within us, really.
Yeah, absolutely. You before know? We finish, knowing how much the music means to you in terms of, you know, where that being your starting point, was there a piece of music? And also, I know the journey of music from that to actually getting it in the final version can be tricky and expensive. But is there a piece of music that you're particularly over the moon that you've managed to get in the show?
I'm very happy that Gloria's in there. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy that the Rodrigo's track at the end of Ep 1 is in there. That's been in the vault for a while, so I was very happy that that got let out.
Was it a huntsman or a player that made you pay the cost, that now assumes relaxed positions and prostitutes your loss? Were you tortured by your own thirst in those pleasures that you seek, that made you Tom the Curious, that makes you James the Weak?
I'm really happy that I'm really, for me,
all of them,
especially the track that we used at the end of Ep 1, Crucify Your Mind. I really, really, really love that. I'm really happy that Joan Armatrading is in there. I'm very.
Sounds like they all made it.
We didn't get the bangles
No,
in.
I'm sure there was.
I don't know, but I'm sure there should have been a bangles.
There was a Fleetwood Mac track that I wanted, but
that was probably way too expensive.
It was just too much. Yeah. It was too expensive. There were a couple of things. There were a couple of sort of deaths of things that I really, really loved. But on the whole, it got in.
It's quite interesting you mentioned Fleetwood, because there's a few kind of big hitters that kind of come up time and time again with people going, it's just too expensive. You're missing out on being part of this lovely creative journey by charging too much for people.
The big one was Grace Jones. I couldn't get any Grace Jones in because it was just
Come on.
I mean, enormous bags of money. Huge, huge bags of money.
Physically taken.
Yeah, literally. So there were a couple, there were, like, on my playlist, there were a couple of Grace Jones tracks, not, like, the, what's it called? Leatherette or something?
It wasn't Grace
Warm
Jones,
Leatherette.
Hit by Emu, was it?
Maybe she's got a problem with puppets.
Maybe there's an issue with puppets.
I'm sure there's a puppet.
Puppets, maybe, no. Yeah.
Maybe I've
charged them 10 million.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I hate them. I hate puppets.
Yeah.
I think this is the other thing, though, made me want to go back. Because, I mean, Sesame Street was the thing that I watched religiously. Mm, yeah. Still sing that kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, woo, 5. And so I feel like there's not enough of that for my kids still, you know, in terms of that, because I felt like it gave
rainbow, didn't we?
Escapism.
Yeah.
To kind of go...
Well, also what an input... I mean, I could wax lyrical about that show, but the thing that's so key to that show is that it was about trying to personify a diverse city.
Mm.
And it was so educational. And it was so radical. And it is so quietly radical. And yet it continues to exist in the mainstream. And that's what I think is really beautiful. I mean, one of the nods, I think, in episode 6 is... McKinley's character LaJoy goes to visit Cecile Marlon's mother, and he looks in the other room, and Cecile's 3-year-old grandson is watching Sesame Street / Good Day Sunshine, our version of, you know, Good Day Sunshine. And the idea is that, you know, careful about the stories you tell, because children listen, and we have a huge responsibility, and the gift that we're given our children to, you know, we're given these children to parent, and how do we parent them? And I'm not just talking about the familiar parent. I'm talking about the parent in this all. I'm talking about the parents of institutions. And so to me, Sesame Street represented that gorgeous good thing of childhood. And I've got a few of those, actually. I love Topsy and Tim and Magic Roundabout. But basically, they were all kind of basically on space cakes, whereas I think Sesame Street had a bit more to say, didn't it? You know, and ultimately, and it's still going to this day. So
I could chat to you for hours about this show. I just want to see... sort of spitting at you. It's just beyond what I imagined it would be. It's just absolutely wonderful. So huge congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
From the score to Eric, that's Vincent Walks Edgar Home by Kifis Ciancia, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Abby Morgan and Lucy Forbes. My huge thanks to Abby and Lucy for taking the time to talk to us. As I said, Eric is streaming on Netflix right now. And do you know what? It is such a refreshing production because it is so many things. It's kind of like the gift that keeps on giving. You think you know what the show's about, and then it takes you in a different direction. The production values on it are phenomenal. The use of music is phenomenal. So if you're looking for something to dive into, I highly, highly recommend it. If you're new to us, we've got well over 400 episodes of Soundtracking for you to listen to, which you can find at edithbowman.com. There's a great search engine there to dive into our library, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on your socials. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do check out our YouTube channel, where we are in the process of uploading a ton of stuff. And then next week, please join us. Really, really excited. If you listen to our episode with Hans Zimmer and Denis Villeneuve, you'll have heard them talk about the wonderful Joe Walker at length. Now, Joe's been a long-term collaborator with Denis Villeneuve and indeed friend of Hans Zimmer. They go way back. And Joe's been responsible for editing quite a number of Denis' films, going back to Arrival, Sicario, Blade Runner. And it was an absolute treat to get the chance to chat to Joe specifically about Dune, the whole Dune 1 and 2, but also diving into their relationship, their collaboration, their process, and the journey that they've all been on together as well as filmmakers and storytellers. So Joe Walker is our guest on next week's episode of the podcast, and I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.